You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As we look at the effects of climate change, one of the world's most symptomatic signs is our coral reefs. Coral reefs are extraordinarily diverse and deeply interconnected. They sustain bountiful ecosystems that half a billion to a billion people depend on for protein. They protect our vulnerable coastlines, absorbing well over 90% of storm energy from hurricanes, typhoons, and tropical cyclones. And yet, more and more are in serious jeopardy, from seasonal bleaching, from warmer temperatures, as well as new diseases and lesions on these remarkable animals. Already, the Florida reef is in jeopardy from a disease called stony coral tissue loss disease that affects half of the coral species in the Caribbean. But scientists are making great strides in understanding coral health, from identifying species resistant to warming, to stabilization efforts on reefs, to incubating coral species in nurseries and transplanting them, as well as new technologies to preserve reefs. My guest today is Julie Burwald, who holds a PhD in ocean science and now is a science writer who has written for the New York Times, Nature, National Geographic, and Texas Monthly. Her new book is titled Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. It's published by Riverhead. Julie Burwald, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich. I'm really delighted to be here.
You know, in a time when oceans are absorbing more and more heat, the news that we hear about the future of coral reefs is pretty uniformly gloomy. And there is plenty of bad news, but the story is far more complex. In fact, life on the rocks offers at least some reasons to be hopeful. Was that a surprise to you when you began this investigation of coral reefs, 4 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd stayed away from the story of coral reefs because I was concerned that, like, there's nothing in this story that's hopeful at all. And I went to this meeting that sort of starts off the book, and I found all these people working in coral reefs who were just really optimistic. And that's when I was like, well, maybe there is a story I could write here. And maybe there is a story I want to spend, you know, a couple years on, because for me, I didn't think I could spend several years on just a story of death and destruction. It's just not my nature. That said, you know, I don't want to be Pollyanna or paint something that's not realistic. It is a critical moment for coral reefs right now.
And if coral reefs do survive, it will be on in no small part to some serious bioengineering, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's happening. And you know, this is an interesting change in philosophy, because for many, many years, we've talked about conservation. I mean, conservation is sort of a whole movement in the United States where we say, hey, let's set aside this, you know, piece of land, these national parks, and then just let nature do its thing and come back. And it's not our place. Like, we don't know what we're doing out there. There's all these side effects. Like, we should be really careful. But when it comes to coral reefs, things are so urgent right now that there's been a change in philosophy, and people are like, no, we got to get out there and help the reefs. We got to add whatever we can to help them get through these stressful times that are coming. So this idea of coral restoration has really blossomed, and, you know, they're not all successes. I saw some that definitely weren't, but there's a lot that are really helping the coral and have potential to make a big difference. You know, just like us, when we know we're getting into a stressful period, if we can sort of eat right and get our good night's sleep and, you know, like, build up our health, it helps us get through that time. And so that's kind of the idea, is like, if we can bolster the health of the coral reefs right now, maybe some of them will have more success as they go into this time of more heat, which is really a stressful, causes a lot of stress for them.
At that Reefs of Futures conference, you know, you heard all sorts of ideas from, you know, how you're building artificial structures for reefs to attach to. And I think you actually did that in the course of your research for the book, you went went down and helped build some of these structures that I believe Mars, the Mars Foundation, I guess, from Mars Candy was funding. And you actually did that. But there were other ideas that were sort of off the chart, like actually trying to cool the water around the reefs. I guess there are all sorts of ideas out there floating on figuring out how best to protect the reefs. What were some of the interesting ideas you heard?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Mars project was one I really didn't expect to find. But the Mars Candy Bar Company, I mean, has probably restored more coral reef than anyone else in the world, which is not something I expected to find, or really anyone really expects. And I don't, you know, there hasn't been a ton of publicity around it either. But Frank Mars, who is the grandson of the Mars founder, he really feels passionate about coral reefs and their health. And he's invested millions of dollars in Indonesia to restore coral reefs. And there the problem isn't yet. I mean, there has been some problems with ocean warming there, but the major kind of bigger problem is this problem of blast fishing, which is where, kind of driven by poverty, a lot of fishermen will use bombs to catch fish. So they cause a big explosion, the fish float to the surface, and they gather them up and catch them that way. But in the what happens when that bomb explodes is it'll destroy a huge portion of the reef as well. And then the rubble just kind of rolls around. And I saw blast scars that were 30 years old where no coral could reestablish itself. So What they've done is come up with these rebar structures. They call them reef stars. And they're just kind of six-legged structures that are about as big around as like if you reach your arms in a circle. And you can tie fragmented coral onto it and then kind of network them together into a galaxy. And it's unbelievable. Within 18 months, there'll be a vibrant reef there. And then they're doing some other really cool stuff. Like they've discovered that, you know, coral reefs are kind of like a forest. They're the structure for all these other animals to live on. And if you start playing the sounds of a healthy coral reef on these restorations where there's kind of just rebar there, the fish will come because they think it's a healthy place to live. So it's like, yeah, so they're working with audio scientists who study the sounds of a healthy reef, and they're actually piping the music of health onto these reefs, and the fish show up and they start pruning away the algae and providing these services for the coral that they really need to be healthy. So it's just an amazing project. And I saw one reef that was 18 months old and it looked great. And then they brought me to one that was 3 years old and you couldn't even see that was restored at all. Like it was astonishingly healthy. So yeah, I mean, there are things we can do that really do seem to make a difference.
That's an amazing story. And, use of technology to do that. But of course, you know, this is one of the things I discovered about coral reefs, and I've discovered a lot in the course of this book, is that, you know, in these warm water oceans, reefs are the main feature of marine life, that the open ocean that is warm doesn't contain a lot of plankton. It doesn't contain as much nutrients for, I guess, the chain of fish that are needed to sustain each other can depend on. So it is really the reefs are these little lifeboats, if you will, in the ocean that are providing most of the life for people to extract fish, for the fish themselves to thrive. And I found that really interesting. Why don't we take a step back and just talk about the biological impact of coral reefs?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you bring up this point because when we think of the tropics, you know, we think of jungles and rainforests and this really rich life. But in the ocean, it's the opposite. The tropics are deserts. The reason is because you can sort of think of an ocean as a two-layer system. So you have the surface layer, which is sunny, which plants need sun, but plants also need fertilizer. And there's just not really much fertilizer in the tropical oceans, because when life dies in the ocean, it sinks down to the depths. And that's where it becomes, like, you know, the bacteria work on it and turn it back into nutrients, like in the soils here. But there's this huge difference between the light at the top and the fertilizer at the bottom. And in the ocean, in the tropical oceans, they're separated very cleanly into a surface and a deep water. But what the corals have done is they've made this alliance with some of the algae. And those algae actually live inside their tissues. And those algae need nutrients. Well, the corals' waste products are nutrients. You know, they are nitrogen and phosphorus and the things that plants need. So the coral feeds the algae those waste products. The algae photosynthesizes and makes sugar and feeds the coral 90% of the sugar they make. So they've kind of like collapsed the whole problem of a desert into just like this little symbiosis that they have. And that symbiosis is so powerful that the corals have so much extra energy from the sugar they get from the algae that they can create these limestone structures that are the great reefs of the seas. And it changed everything. It changed everything for the oceans, because those reefs are super productive. Like you said, they're more productive than almost any other ecosystem on our planet, and just full of life. And it shouldn't be there at all, but it's because of this incredibly tight alliance. I call it the badass merger in my book, which is a connection between this animal that's a coral that gives its waste directly to the algae, which is like a plant, which gives its sugar to the coral. So it's pretty amazing. And that tightly knit symbiosis is really the root of everything. And so you can think of coral, even though they're animals, you can think of them as solar powered animals, because they get their power straight from this algae. And you can think of coral reefs as the greatest solar powered construction project on our planet.
That's true. And, yeah. and what's really interesting is one of the questions that you were asking, and what scientists are asking as well, is when a coral reef begins to bleach out and it is in danger and dying, and oftentimes you see that the algae is no longer there. And the question is, who breaks that symbiosis relationship, and what have scientists found?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I found the most amazing of all the research, which is that this idea of bleaching has been known for more than 100 years. And what bleaching is just like you said, it's when the algae and the coral break this badass merger and the algae leaves the coral. But what we don't know is who throws the switch. Like, whose idea is it to break up? You know, like, is it the coral saying, I'm feeling stressed, I don't have space on my plate for anything else right now, including being invaded, you know, having an algae living in my tissues. So my immune system's going to ramp up and just like kick out all the foreign invaders. Or is it the algae saying, I'm not getting the support I'm used to having from this coral? You know, maybe it's not feeding me as much nutrients anymore. I'm not so happy. I'm going to reveal myself to the coral's immune system so that it kicks me out. So, you know, we don't know which one's happening, despite like a decade of research, which is just astonishing. And so it's one of the great mysteries that remains.
I noticed you were at one conference where a doctoral student was talking. She started with an idea that it was, I think it was the algae leaving the coral. And by the end, she was saying, well, it could be the coral leaving the algae.
Yeah, the coral kicking the algae out, right. And oh my gosh, I mean, really, it's so incredible that we don't know. But it's definitely an area of really active research. And it's one of these great mysteries to me that something so powerful and important could remain unknown to us after looking for so long, that it just kind of, there's a piece of me that's just filled with wonder about it. And I kind of like that. I'm okay to be filled with wonder.
My guest today is Julie Berwald. She has a PhD in ocean science. She works as a science writer. And her second book is titled, and new book is titled, Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. It's published by Riverhead. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I have to tell you, one of the first disheartening stories you share is about the Florida Reef off the Florida Keys. I have to say, for my own life, that's the first and only time I've seen a reef. We were on a fishing trip when I was a kid. It was 45 years ago. You know, that reef was teeming with life. You know, when you take a boat out to the reef, you know, you have this period where there's really not a lot that you can see. All of a sudden you come to the reef and it's boom, fish everywhere. You know, it just seems to be flowing with life. And it was a great experience to see that. And it was so disheartening to hear what's happening to that reef. What is happening there?
Gosh. Well, First of all, I'm so happy you were able to see that really healthy reef from 40 years ago. Back then, the reef was full of this kind of coral, this branching coral that looks like elk horns, or some of them look kind of more like moose horns. I guess they call them stag horns. They have undergone a huge die-off. And the original die-off, there were lots of diseases that swept through the Florida Reef. And those jungles, those just like jungly forests of coral are largely gone now. In some places, only 2% of the hard coral remain in the Florida Reef Trap, which is just tragic. And likely, those coral were first weakened by a change in water quality, and a lot of that has to do with runoff from the land of fertilizers. So like we were talking about, you know, the tropics are this sort of very nutrient poor desert like place. And when you have extra nutrients running off, like in fertilizers, you know, from putting fertilizers on the land in excess, the coral aren't used to that and it makes them sick. And so they were sickened probably initially by a fall in water quality, and then the ocean started to heat up and these bleaching events started. So it was kind of like a double whammy that's really caused a huge decline in the health of the reef. And then I think what you're talking about is this really tragic story, which is this new disease that Yes. started in around 2014 near the port of Miami, which is called Skittle D, and it stands for Stony Coral Tissue Loss Disease. And it's kind of like Ebola, where it just melts the tissue of the coral away. And so some of the remaining colonies that were like hundreds of years old have been dying in just a matter of weeks. And this disease, we still don't really know the pathogen. Some people think it's bacterial, but it attacks about 20 different species of coral, which is a lot. And it's now jumped off of Florida and it's throughout the Caribbean. So it's a big problem.
And of course, that is Hurricane Alley down there. And once the reef it begins to degrade, all of a sudden the people living on the islands and even on mainland Florida are going to feel the effects during hurricane season.
It's true, but you know, it's actually an interesting mixed bag on that front, because coral reefs are a really great absorber of wave storm energy. So a healthy reef can deflect, I guess, or absorb 97% of the energy of a storm as it barrels towards land. And one of the things that hurricanes can do, and we saw this in the Bahamas with Hurricane Dorian, which was just a terrible storm. But what it did was it mixed up cool water from the depths. And that cool water was actually really good for the corals. And it stopped a potential bleaching in its tracks. So when it comes to hurricanes, yes, they can be destructive, and they're definitely destructive on reefs that are sick. But if there's a healthy reef, the hurricanes, I mean, the reefs can really benefit us by being there, and the hurricane can actually stir up some cold water and help a reef out too. So it's there's more nuance to that story, which is kind of a good thing.
One of the bright spots of Life on the Rocks, your book, is the fact that what we have found is that some corals are far more adaptive than we probably thought 20 years ago. There's been a lot of research. I mean, there are scientists growing coral in labs and trying to figure out exactly, you know, how you create coral that is a little more resistant and to temperature change and all the other issues affecting our oceans. And we find that some species of coral, which there are, who knows how many there are.
About 800.
800. Yeah. Some of them are far more adaptable than others. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the coolest parts, I think. The coral themselves might have more tools in their toolbox than we really know. And not just the coral, but the algae too. And maybe I'll just mention that part because I think this is really fascinating. So after a coral bleaches, it doesn't necessarily die. If the water cools down, it can be recolonized by algae. And what scientists are discovering is that sometimes the algae that recolonizes the coral is a different kind of algae. And these new colonizers actually have a higher thermal threshold, so they can handle hotter temperatures. But there's a little bit of a trade-off because those algae also are not as generous with the sugar. So they only give about 60% of the sugar they make to the coral. So the coral's kind of making this decision, do I let myself get colonized by a different kind of algae that will feed me some sugar and maybe be able to handle this heating ocean, but I might be kind of on like a diet? Or, you know, do I go with the old guy who I was used to for millions of years, who was really generous with me, but I'm, you know, risking bleaching again? So that's one thing that's happening. And we're just kind of watching to see what the coral are going to do out there. If they're going to make a new alliance, you know, like trade out business partners, or if they're going to, this is a really evolving story, and it's super interesting. And then the other part is the coral side. It turns out coral are really good at making hybrids. So like two different species will form offspring that are, you know, hybrids that are half of each. And so that allows the genetic pool of the corals to get mixed up a lot. And we don't know like what genes may get traded among different species of coral through this hybridization process. And it's possible that, you know, the corals will start sharing the genes to handle a warmer ocean with each other through this process of hybridization and gene transfer. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of possibility out there. And that's stuff that we, in the lab, coral scientists are definitely looking at it. But in the ocean, you know, that's just a big petri dish for the coral to try new ideas. And we'll see what happens.
My guest today is Julie Burwald, who is a science writer. And her new book is titled Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. In our remaining time, I'd like to talk about something that, in one way, it's good because there are really strong efforts to protect 50 reefs around the world. But it's also disheartening because a lot of reefs in the Caribbean, along the Florida coast, have, in a sense, been written off at this point. What's the most exciting idea about trying to protect those 50 reefs in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of talk about this in a philosophical way, like if you have a lifeboat and you can only put a certain number of people in it, how do you choose who gets to go in the lifeboat? And it's a moral, ethical question that I think deserves a lot of wrangling with. But that said, maybe I'll point to one reef that is part of the 50 reefs, and that's the reef in the Red Sea. That reef, because of its geological history, is already like pre-acclimated to warmer weather, to warmer ocean water. Because of the way the Red Sea is formed, the larvae that came in to form those coral reefs had to pass through an area of warm water. So only the ones who could survive that actually lived to establish the reefs that exist in the Red Sea now. And also the Red Sea is kind of on the northern end of the corals range, so it's likely to warm up a little bit more slowly. And what's also kind of amazing about these reefs is our next climate meeting, which is known as the COP, is going to be in September, and it's going to be just a couple miles away from those reefs. So the people whose job it is to figure out what we're going to do about this warming planet are literally on the edge of this reef whose existence depends on the decisions they make. And I think there's a really powerful story just in the connection between those two things happening. You know, it's our decisions up here that influence the corals and all that they're doing beneath the sea. And I think that we have to recognize that our decisions do matter. They matter a lot. They matter for the existence of, you know, who knows, 800,000 species that depend on the reef. They matter for the food that a half a billion to a billion people use as their major source of protein. And they matter for the reefs, you know, as I said, like as storm absorbers, for absorbing the energy from storms that's comes pummeling at us on land. So I think that reef is kind of situated in a really interesting place, you know, philosophically, morally, ethically, and ecologically, and politically, I guess. And so that's kind of a good one to talk about.
Well, Julie Bearwell, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rich.
Science writer Julie Bearwald speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Nature, and National Geographic, and her latest book is titled Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. It's published by Riverhead. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.